Ray Gingrich is a leading Christian scholar in the Anabaptist tradition, a tradition not well known in Australia but recognised by many of you through its association with two denominations that are associated generally in the public mind with quaintness, that is, the Mennonites and the Amish. And Ray Gingrich is going to help, among other things, to explain all that to us tonight on Sunday night. Ray Gingrich, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Ray, you're somebody who is intensely involved with the Mennonite tradition. You've got a local commitment to the church. Clearly, the Mennonite faith and what it means is something that is still lively enough for you to commit yourself to. What distinguishes a contemporary Mennonite? What holds you as a scholar to the Mennonite tradition?
Great question, and it's one that many of us continue to ask. And as you've already slightly alluded to, these Mennonites used to be quaint, and that's what a lot of people think about now. And when we drop much of our quaintness, you know, those head coverings and the buttons and all that and the Pennsylvania Dutch, then the question is, so what's left? And I think we're still struggling with that. So I, as a theologian, and that's part of why I chose theology and history, I actually did my doctoral work in 16th century Anabaptist stuff. And as is so often the case, you know, you do it presumably for something out here, but if you could be 100% honest with yourself, you know you're answering, trying to come to grips with your own questions. So
yes, it's a question as much about who I am as who we are.
Exactly. So
let's talk for a moment about that extrinsic side, if you like, because for so many years, particularly if we can talk about the subgroups that are known in popular culture, groups like the Amish and the more conservative Mennonites were associated with a form of dress, style of living, with rural communities, with something to do with connectedness to the earth and the rhythm of the seasons. Yet, at a certain point in time, that becomes so disconnected from contemporary culture, you have to say, what relevance do I have? The problem is, if you've invested so much in preserving the cultural form, the cost of losing that may be to lose your soul as well.
Correct. Hey, you're right on. I've taught for the past 30 years at a Mennonite university, and largely in ethics, and part of this has been in general education, so I had relatively large classes. And in the beginning of my teaching, back in 1977, I could take about any class and say, how many of you either came from the farm or your parents came from the farm? And 80% of my students would hold up their hands. In the last number of years when I did that, they sort of gawked. What's this professor asking? What does he mean now? And maybe 10 to 15% of my students will do that. So there's been this rapid shift from the land to business to the cities. And with that comes this large question. Along with that is what we have called a rediscovery, say, of our own historical roots. This begins already in the mid-20th century earlier, but really comes into flowering in the 60s and 70s.
So if you don't have your externals, what do you have? You have your history. Who are we? And what does that tell us about who we might be today?
Exactly. And in our university, again and again, when it came to deciding, this is Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, when it came to deciding what should the next direction be that we go into, there were a few of us that continued to say, look, we have a major state university, James Madison University, on the other side of town, that's 10 times as big as we are. We can't afford to duplicate them. If we want to survive and if we want to be faithful to who we are, we have to find those things that the larger society needs that are inner central to who we are.
So it's not just about who we are, it's what does society demand of us or what can we give to society?
That's right, because central to who we are, and I haven't really responded to that question, is community. Community not just for ourselves, but community, at least we like to think, in terms of the larger world. And central to that community, what holds that together, we go back to the 16th century Reformation, is a new understanding of the scriptures. The scriptures, not as a flat book, but the Christian scriptures focused on the person of Jesus, specifically the historical Jesus.
But the historical Jesus seen through the experience of Mennonite tradition.
Through the experience of Mennonite tradition, and we like to think of much broader than Mennonite tradition. When we refer to that broader experience, we usually use the term Anabaptist. In other words, our understanding is that though relatively few may be practicing the way of Jesus, that is still central to the Christian heritage. And so this evening I'll be giving a presentation in which I simply say, look, we have 3,000, or depending how far back you want to go, you can say 5,000 years of human history. And we've been using violence, and it's been escalating and escalating, and we now know that it's failing us. And if we continue to go in the direction we're going, we can anticipate essentially being annihilated. Then I come around and say, but, you know, we do have something in our heritage, whether we're Anglican or whether we're Presbyterian or Uniting Church or whatever, or Mennonite, we share a common Jesus. And Jesus would say, follow me. And that may sound very, very quaint, but we think the message is as powerful and as relevant today as it's been back there.
But there are certain elements of that message you bring out, and I want to get to those elements shortly. But before we do, just introduce us or refresh us as to what this great Anabaptist tradition is, because it goes back to the Reformation, the great split in the universal church that occurred in the 16th century. And most of us understand that there are two great streams of the Protestant Reformation, one that's associated with Luther and the Moravians and on through Wesley and the Methodists, the other that's associated with Calvin and Geneva and then John Knox and Presbyterianism. The Anabaptists form a group that fits comfortably into neither. They were a group that is sometimes called the Radical Reformation.
You've done your homework. beautifully. We actually sometimes say Anabaptists are neither Catholic nor Protestant, only to turn around and say Anabaptists are both Catholic and Protestant. And the Anabaptists were, as you said, a group that emerged out of the 16th century. It's more difficult to get hold of them because they emerged at different places and actually under different social and political circumstances.
What was similar enough about them to give them the name Anabaptist?
Because they form communities, and as a sign of entering that community, these were religious communities, they understood them to be biblical, and as a sign of entering that community, they baptized in different ways. It wasn't always the same form.
It was always adult baptism, though, wasn't it?
It was always adult baptism. They said infant baptism cannot be on the confession of your faith. Baptism within the Christian church has to be the believers being baptized, and only adults can be believers.
Now, there's an interesting paradox here. Allow me to pick this up. Anabaptist tradition believes in adult baptism, and central to Anabaptist, to that adult baptism, is the conscious understanding. That is, me, have to make that commitment. I have to be the one who's transformed. Now, that also goes to something else. It goes to, I am the one who interprets for myself, in a really radical tradition. And so numerous interpretations of the Bible come up. Now, that leads, in one sense, you can see the foundations of modern individualism, of the European Enlightenment, of all of that, in this radical understanding of the individual. But on the other hand, I look at the Mennonite and Amish tradition and see essentially a communitarian vision. Is there a paradox there?
I don't like to call it a paradox, although I know that on the surface it really appears to be a paradox. I'm not sure whether we can bring our listeners along or not, but we like to think, and I like to think, maybe I should just speak as an individual, that the fullness of the self is realized in the context of community. If that's a paradox itself, and we all know that when we come into community, there are certain edges or certain aspects of the self that we need to sort of surrender or give up or soften in order to be a part of this community. But in the context of that community, I come to a new realization of who I am, at the same time to a new appreciation that I cannot live the Christian faith by myself. So in that sense, we're really Catholic in the sense of salvation is within the context of the church. We might not make it as exclusive as the Catholics sometimes make it, but we see salvation as not just a me event, but as a corporate event. Not just something that once happened, but something that happens in the context of living. And that's why lifestyle is so important. The way to know this Jesus is not fundamentally through propositional truth and through the creeds, although most Mennonites don't deny those. Most Mennonites would actually want to affirm those. But the way to know this Jesus, as one of these 16th century persons said, no one can know Jesus unless he, she follow him in life daily. So it's really quite a modern way of knowing. We know by doing. And by doing, we become transformed or changed or come to new ways again of looking at this Jesus.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest is Ray Gingrich, leading Christian scholar in the Anabaptist tradition, currently visiting Australia. Ray, in a moment we're going to have some music, another selection of yours, but first, just answer a little sort of minor historical point. Tell us the origins of the two names, Mennonite and Amish, and how they came out of the Anabaptist tradition.
And in between there's yet a third one, or a prior one, Anabaptist. The Anabaptists emerged in Switzerland in 1525, and immediately, this was in January, and by that spring and into the summer, we have the Peasants' Wars emerging. And hundreds, if not thousands, of Anabaptists, of later Anabaptists, were caught up in those Peasants' Wars. They were looking for economic justice. They were looking for greater freedom. They were looking for the self-appointment of their own pastors. It was the beginning of the breakup of the feudal age. And when violence failed, they picked up their Bibles and read them through new lenses and said, aha, there it is. God never wanted us to use the sword to structure our communities.
The swords became plowshares.
The swords became plowshares.
Quite literally.
Quite literally. And with a lot of struggle, it didn't happen overnight. And that's why some Mennonites, we're still debating, we have our annual conferences and things in between. What is the best way to verbalize this? What really were the essential points of this Anabaptist movement? But in any case, about a decade later, a Dutch priest by the name of Menno Simons was having strong convictions along these lines. Again, influenced by some of the same influences that the Swiss people were. Among this was not only the breakup of the feudal age, but there was the rise of humanism, of religious humanism, not secular humanism, but a new understanding of the human being. And there were a group of these peasants took over legitimately, legally, a town, only to get these weird visions of the coming of Christ and all kinds of messed up stuff. This is what we call the Minster episode in 1534 and 35. And out of that, Menno's brother was one of the people that was killed in that mess. And Menno sees these hundreds, thousands of people as sheep without a shepherd. And that's where we get the name Menno. We were the Mennoists, Menno Simons, and then the Mennonites. And later, these people began to, they were ethically oriented, and when we're ethically oriented, we don't dispute doctrine, we dispute what does it mean to say that. And so they began to split, and out of that split came the Amish, the followers of Jacob Ammon.
So the Amish and the Mennonites splits out of the Anabaptist movement, both named after their founders.
Exactly.
Like, their followers.
And contrary to what is sometimes thought, the Amish are actually a split off the Mennonites, not the Mennonites, first of all, a split off the Amish.
You also mentioned a sub-theme there when we were just talking about the way in which coming out of the Peasants' Revolt and wars of that period in the 16th century, Anabaptists found a couple of distinctives. One of them was adult baptism. The other was that war and violence are no way to go, that we should beat our swords into ploughshares. And this has been a continuing contribution of the Anabaptist, and particularly the Mennonite tradition, along with the Quakers, a very strong sense of pacifism. Do you see that as one of the things that you bring to the table today?
I do. And it emerges right out of what we call discipleship, following Jesus, because we see Jesus as ultimately having needed to choose between taking life and giving life, and he chose to give life. So it's that new way of knowing Jesus, not through medieval philosophy, but through as old as the Hebrews, as modern as the current classroom, by doing. And those three things, community, following Jesus, and pacifism or nonviolence, are very central. And what I like about this is that it seems to me that this nonviolence can be applied. Some of my Mennonite brothers and sisters would be cautious about this, but I have increasingly strong feelings about it, can be applied through media or medium other than Jesus. So Gandhi, although he studied Jesus, worked together the Christian faith and certain aspects of the Hindu tradition and came up with this truth force, this satyagraha. And I see that as of the same stuff that we're trying to talk about and sharing.
That's interesting in that Gandhi himself acknowledges the debt he owes to Christianity. In fact, some of his Hindu followers weren't too pleased that he grabbed certain aspects of Christianity. And it also goes to another deeper conflict within the essential nature of Christianity about God's relationship to the world. Is God out there, or is this world basically ruined and abandoned by God, and God's only job is to, or our only job is to put people in the heavenly lifeboat? You take the clear view that God's out there still working, and he still loves the world.
God is still out there loving the world, and sometimes I'm not sure whether I should talk of them mostly or her, mostly as being out there loving the world, or being right among us loving the world.
It takes us to the heart of one of the great crises of contemporary American culture. It's the individual vis the community, and it's the way in which we relate to the world, through force or through gentleness.
It is.
It's a very contemporary dilemma.
I'm not sure this is the most appropriate medium, and I'll keep it low, but only to say, yes, I am an American. Yes, there are many things about my country I love. But right now, we're going through a deep crisis. And right now, I feel as though I'm in the belly of the beast being that Western superpower. And my struggle is not to be dissolved by the acids in that belly.
It's a fight over who is the church, too. I mean, on one side, you get groups like, say, James Dobson and Focus on the Family, and those groups who could loosely be identified with the political right and have become known as the religious right.
Very much so.
And on the other hand, you have this tradition which goes right back to the foundation of America, the Declaration of Independence prior to that, which is represented by the tradition you're speaking to.
Right. We also have to be careful not to be holier than the others. At the same time,
you could be tempted to see it in apocalyptic terms, though, as a fight for the soul of America.
Yes, as it has been said by numerous people. And we, of course, are continue to work at the peace issue and try to find ways to bridge the gap between our group of faith and those people who might not hold the same faith, who might not hold it with the same intensity, who might not claim the same historical heritage and so on, but nevertheless need that same power of peace and love and nonviolence, as opposed to thinking that might makes right and that those who have the most violence are in control.
It's the ethical dimension that we could talk about as well. As you say, one doesn't just theologize about this stuff. It's how you live it
that counts. That's right.
Now, that can take you in all sorts of problematic directions. particularly if you are moved to say, my faith means that I must act in the marketplace.
And it does. My faith means I must act in the marketplace. I think to deny that is to withdraw, is instead of being pacifist, opposed to war, is to be passive in inaction, and that's not what we need. So maybe I could just say two things here, just mention them. We don't have to go into details. One way in which I try to place my faith in the marketplace is through my teaching career. We have on the Eastern Mennonite campus now a Center for Justice and Peace Building. It used to be a conflict transformation program, and we began to move into other areas. We began to move into restorative justice, where we work with the judicial system, and we learn a lot from Australia and New Zealand about that. And we have a program that's for trauma healing and restoration. So we're now calling it the Center for Justice and Peace Building. The other area is a more personal area. My wife and I are military tax resisters. Almost 50% of our income tax goes to military purposes. That's excluding Social Security. And it doesn't make sense to some of us that we should have exemption from military training. Our young men and women are not coerced to go into the military. They can take conscientious objection exemption. That we should have that exemption for our young people and then have the middle-aged and the older people who are in the greater income brackets pay to put other people's children into the military. So
the government doesn't agree with you, though.
The government doesn't agree with us.
This puts you in breach of the law.
It does. It's a form of constant annual civil disobedience.
Have you had visits from the IRS?
Oh, yes. During the 80s, I was audited by the IRS, 10 years straight. And we play the cat and mouse game. The IRS doesn't want to arrest me. The IRS doesn't want to take my car. The IRS doesn't want to take my home. The publicity would be huge and negative. I, on the other hand, can't afford to have the IRS take my home. And then to add to that irony, what my wife and I, and we're not alone in this, but there are all too few of us, are really working at is to, if I may use religious language, to convert the church. We don't anticipate converting the IRS. But each year, come April 15th, we send a letter to the IRS commissioner outlining our position, saying why we're withholding these funds, making very clear to him that we are not tax resistors, we're military tax resistors, that we believe in the payment of taxes for good constructive causes. So in that same letter, we send checks copies of checks that we've sent to Christian Peacemaker teams, to the Mennonite Central Committee, to our local congregation for indigence and so on, so that they know we've paid that money.
So that the equivalent of what you deem as the military tax you put into...
Immediately, and other purposes. They, of course, don't accept it for that. But now the irony is, the real thrust of that letter is the copies, the people who get copies. And they are church people, our church headquarters, about it. Because if the Mennonites and the Quakers and the Church of the Brethren, the historical peace churches, would all stand together and would withhold the military portions of the income taxes, the government would need to take action.
It would provoke a considerable discussion, I would imagine, a public discussion that would be extraordinarily public. Our guest on Sunday night, Ray Gingrich, Mennonite, leading Christian scholar in the Anabaptist tradition. And Ray is about challenging us about the way we live our lives. Ray Gingrich, let's talk about generational change. You've spoken about it within your own denomination, that is, how when one has to leave aside the externals of religion, you are forced back to re-examine the internals, that is what keeps you centrally aligned. And you've said that critical to that is the peace tradition, but that takes you right into the heart of the American marketplace. You've staked your claim by saying, well, my commitment to peace means that I have to withhold part of my income from governmental service. Now, that wouldn't have made you popular at any time in the United States.
Correct.
Yet post 9/11, that becomes a decision of an entirely different order. And you are saying, my denomination, or for me, this is where I must stand, and for others, this is where we must stand.
Right.
Post 9/11, this for most Americans, that's a hard ask. It's very hard for them to even comprehend why a conservative, lovely group of people would ask them to do such a thing.
Correct. And I must, just for the accuracy of who we are, at least half Mennonites are Republicans. And would fewer Mennonites have voted for George Bush, he would certainly not have gotten elected the second time. Secondly, there are many people in the United States today who are tax resistors and who are strongly opposed to the military. They may not have the Anabaptist tradition. It may not all flow out of their service of following Jesus, but they simply say, we have gone the route of violence and violence has failed us. We have tried the route of nonviolence, and we have a century. There is a whole large documentary volume out on a truth, a force more powerful on nonviolence in the 20th century. And our public radio station in the U.S. Published a series of DVDs on this. So what I'm trying to say is, we should, as Mennonites, not think of ourselves as sort of having an exclusive voice in this peace witness.
No, but you choose to join a group who are regarded as on the outside rather than on the inside.
That is correct. Very correct. And I think that's a, it's a very observant kind of point, because I got to the point in my own Christian life where I said, unless there's more to the Christian faith than I've found so far, I'm going to have to find some other vocation. I was an ordained minister at that point already. I was working for the church in Europe. But I just said, the world is so big and there's so many needs, and unless there's more to the Christian faith than what you've referred to as the inward piety. And I studied further. It was actually under the man of John Howard Yoder, who is more or less internationally known now. And I came to, it's not the classic conversion, but a new turn in life. And John let me know that, Ray, there are others that have had the questions you have. There are others that have gone through the struggles that you have. We need people like you.
Is that part of the problem? I'll widen this out. Is that part of the problem with contemporary evangelical Christianity that's been so focused on itself that the world has basically said, you're irrelevant, you don't speak to me anymore? I mean, unless you have something to say which is relevant to the world, who
and
are
then,
you?
I would say yes and yes again, and then to exacerbate that problem, those very people have gone into politics in the name of Jesus, in the name of God. And so if we don't have tools to sort of analyze this, we think those are the Christians. And that's our predicament.
How then do you face this contemporary predicament of Christianity? You have Christianity and politics in America governed by people who, one, don't believe in government, and secondly, don't believe in the sort of Christianity you do, which has an ethical face in the world.
That's a hard question. That's a hard question. You know, it hits from every way. It's the question that makes me despair, and I'm struggling for hope. And it's part of my coming to hope is to find people with whom to dialogue, to find people who welcome a new voice, to find other Christians who will share these same kinds of convictions, and hold out until the. And as Pete Seeger sings, you know, the darkest moment is just before the light breaks. And that image comes to me many times. And I wonder, Lord, when's the light going to break?
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest is Mennonite scholar Ray Gingrich. and struggling Christian, Ray Gingrich. That notion of the struggle, you've articulated it very well, that it's always a wrestling with who I am against who the community is or what the world out there expects of me and asks of me. Paul Tillich, the great scholar, theologian, once wrote a book called On the Boundary, that if you're not on the boundary between sort of faith and doubt or between religion and politics, you're not really being relevant. But it's a hard place to be, Ray.
And it's a risky place.
And most Christians don't actually want Christianity to be the hard place. They want it to be the place where they come for refuge.
And that's part of what my focus of writing is at the present. I think that theologians too long have used medieval metaphysics to do their as the basis for their theology. And I think we just have to begin to use the social sciences, the behavioral sciences, including anthropology. And for me, I've come to see the human species, and perhaps accentuated in our postmodern era, wanting an absolute. And not being able to find an absolute in the real world, if I may say so, we create our absolutes. And then, as Peter Berger, or the sociologists of knowledge, have so well said, we create our institutions and our structures, and having forgotten that we created them, we bow down and worship them. And it seems to me that is what evangelical Christianity is doing. It has created its church structures, its firm doctrines, its absolute claims about God, and having created those claims doctrinally, now injects nationalism into that, saying we are a Christian nation, and by that meaning the United States believes this stuff, which we don't, but many people don't get the difference, injects nationalism into that and proclaims it as the word of God.
That infusion of nationalism and religion becomes known popularly in some ways as a sort of American civil religion. It's somehow the religious underpinning of the state has caused some discussion even in Republican circles. And you mentioned that many of the Mennonites are Republicans. Is there not a fracturing of that conservative consensus these days, because these fundamental issues are now being teased out? That is, not only constitutional questions, but questions of the nature of God in society, the way God is expressed.
Very much so. Very much so.
And that becomes really fertile territory for you to plough, if we continue that metaphor.
That's right. So I'm asking, this great riddle, that we have a pacifist Jesus, who presumably is the fullest, according to the Christian faith, the fullest revelation of God that we have. And yet this pacifist Jesus has a warrior God. Strange contradictions in our theology. And I become quite convinced that the images that we hold of power, including the images of the nature of God, have a powerful influence in our subconsciousness as to how we think the world's problems can be alleviated or solved or healed. So if we have a warrior God, we think of that kind of power to resolve the world's ills. If we, on the other hand, have a God in the nature of Jesus, who loves and ministers and heals and even dies for the sake of the other, the world becomes a very different place. Imagine what would have happened if the United States, after 9/11, would have had a vision of even just had weaknesses in its foreign policy, weaknesses enough to admit that some of the things we did were not the way they should have been, and began to even make not a 180-degree change, but even if we could have had a 40 or 45 or 60-degree change, what a different world we could have today.
Ray Gingrich, it's been fascinating to talk with you. Let me ask you just one final question, and you've teased out one element of it. We started off by saying a religion which loses its external trappings has to really look to itself, and you've teased out one of the things that the tradition brings to us today. It's this engagement with pacifism in culture, that we actually need to think very carefully about the way we engage in civil debate and civil and discourse. What are the other distinctives which carry you forward? Because you've been an activist, not just in that we've talked about your activism on the tax front, but you've been an activist in other areas, like in world development. You've got very carefully engaged in all of those. So what are the things which you say, not just the Christian tradition, but my particular bit of the tradition now offers to the world? Okay, we notch one up there for thinking very carefully about the issue of conflict. What are the other distinctives?
I hope I'm not too abstract, but I keep asking myself this very question. And my bottom line runs something like this: that which is life-giving, that which does not hurt, but more than does not hurt, that which heals, that which makes joy, that which bonds people together in positive ways, that to me is of God, and that to me is, that's where I want to participate. And that which is death-dealing, which does the opposite, which kills, which destroys, which is competitive to the point of being oppressive, and that to me then becomes the demonic.
Ray Gingrich, we're going to finish with a selection of yours, one we've had to dig out of the archive, we've had to recover it from the vinyl. It's Mary Travers of Peter, Paul and Mary fame, using Sibelius's great tune that has become known as Finlandia, but a set of words which speak to a vision of the world. Just introduce it for us.
I don't know where we were first introduced to this. I suppose it was with the... this is on a Peter, Paul, and Mary record, because Mary Travers is the Mary of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And in our world travels, in our attempts to transcend the national boundaries, and in discovering, yes, if Christianity is going to be worth its salt, it's got to transcend national boundaries. And in that sense, the Mary Travers song, Finlandia, just addresses this, regardless of whether you hold to one religion or another. The skies are blue everywhere, and I've been here in Sydney now for a week and just marvel at how the other side of the world looks. It's as beautiful as anything I've ever seen on the northern side.
Ray Gingrich, it's been great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us on Sunday night.
And I must say thank you, John.